You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It can be difficult to talk about race. Well, certainly if you are white. If you're a person of color, you live with race every single day. But personal reflections and conversations on race and racial equity are long overdue on an interpersonal and societal level. My guest today and her co-author have facilitated work on race relations throughout their career. And as parents of adopted African-American sons, they have firsthand experience, at least on a small portion, of the routine indignities people of color face in America. Their new book, Let's Talk About Race, A Guide for White People, offers a frank assessment on why whites struggle to talk about race and how to overcome the personal obstacles that preclude those conversations. The book offers advice on how to see the varied forms of racism, how whites normalize privilege, offers an essential history and historic disparities on race that helps inform the present, along with prompts for personal reflection and conversation. Fern Johnson is a senior research scholar and professor emerita at Clark University, specializing in race, culture, and language. She's the author of several books, and her co-author and partner, Marlene Fine, is a professor emerita at Simmons University, specializing in cultural diversity and dialogue. Fern joins us today on Studio Tulsa to talk about her book, Let's Talk About Race, A Guide for White People. Fern Johnson, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting us to be on your program.
Yeah, your book, Let's Talk Race, which was written with your co-author, Marlene Fine. Why is it important to have these conversations, and why do white people struggle to speak about race?
Well, I would answer the first question about why it's important to have these conversations by saying that it's always been important. We should have been having these conversations. The imperative for having them has changed and reshaped at different points in time. So now it's as though everything, you know, has figuratively and literally blown up. But that's not to say that it hadn't before. We finished our book in the spring of 2020. We literally turned it in a couple of days before George Floyd was killed, you know, by Derek Chauvin. But there's this context, you know, that has been building up to this eruption. And there's probably, we hope, more of a recognition of systemic racism after the coronavirus pandemic, after the death of George Floyd, than there was before. But this is still crisis-oriented. So we hear all these calls, we have to have a conversation, we have to have a national conversation. You know, the bestseller lists are filled with fabulous, wonderful, hard books to read by black authors. And that's all terrific. We need to learn, we need to read, but we need to talk to each other. And we especially need to talk to each other if we hope to get any meaningful action in terms of addressing racial justice, systemic racism. And we can't just be thinking about this when there's a crisis, you know, it just, because the crises happen over and over again. Now we have Dante Wright. Dante Wright was killed in the suburb, Brooklyn Center of Minneapolis, where I grew up. You know, George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis. I mean, this is a point that no place is exempt. I mean, he was killed in Minneapolis, maybe 10 or 12 blocks from where I lived when I was a graduate student. And, you know, it brings home the reality that this is everywhere. Well, it's because it's a systemic issue, and we live separately. Blacks and whites are residentially segregated, educationally segregated. Friendships, you know, tend to be same race, same ethnicity. You know, we have got to learn to come together, to hear each other, to listen, to know the stories of people who are different from us. It's an imperative. We should have been doing this all along, and it's not to say that it doesn't happen at all. I mean, there are terrific initiatives in some communities and religious organizations, you know, to do this work. But it's got to be bigger than that.
Certainly every community has its name. Here in Tulsa, it's Terrence Crutcher. And and we've had other incidents as well. A few years ago, we had a reserve sheriff's deputy that made the same sort of claim, the same sort of error that happened in Dante Wright's case, which was, mistaking the taser for the gun. And so this is nothing new, yet it keeps happening. I was struck by something you talked about. It says, you know, right now we're having crisis-oriented conversations. And I found in most crises, it's really difficult to get, I mean, no doubt we need to have these conversations, but the lasting conversations, I mean, they can only start with a crisis. They have to continue once the immediate crisis is perceived to be past. And I don't know that we can ever get to that point, at least in the immediate future. What do we need to keep in mind about these crisis-oriented conversations?
Well, the conversations that we need, some of them will be about the crises, but I think some of the conversations have to be about issues related to, you know, Black lives, white lives, that aren't about the crises. You know, to build some better understanding of what has happened, you know, historically, that is imprinted, you know, that manifests itself in the way we live today. I mean, they can be conversations that bring up, you know, relatively small issues, or where we hear something and we learn to respond to it in a different way because we're thinking now not just in our own perspective, but from someone else's perspective. You know, usually when there's a crisis, you know, like all the news stuff, we get more information, you know, as the days go by, and we get a little, you know, nuance in the perspective, you know, and then we're on to something else. And obviously, we're in this period of time where there's a lot of tension about policing, and there's a lot of attention to some of these practices. But what unfortunately happens if we don't sit down and talk to each other is that everything gets polarized. So I don't know about Tulsa, but, you know, here in Massachusetts, here where I live in a suburb of Boston, there are signs out, defend the police. There are signs out that take defund the police, cross out defund and put defend. Mm-hmm. And it's much more nuanced than that, you know. I mean, and it's hard to get to the point of people understanding that unless they have conversations outside of the context of what do we need to do right now today. We need to have those. So maybe town X, city X, you know, does need right now to, in this example, talk about and initiate some changes in terms of a variety of things related to policing. But we need broader involvement in that for people to understand what the issues are.
I was struck by something you wrote early in the book. It's talked about a public forum in the wake of a crisis where, you know, you had community leaders talking about race. And it was an interesting exchange of ideas. It was somewhat, maybe a somewhat stilted, platitude-heavy conversation. It was maybe a starting point in your community, but that was it. And the same thing has happened in Tulsa and probably countless other communities.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, that sort of, I think sometimes communities say, this suffices our conversation, and it's just not adequate, is it?
No, Rich, it's not, because you never get past, you know, the specific instance, or, you know, everybody has a chance often in these events to say something if they want to say it, but they then go home. and, you know, that's sort of the end of it. And dialogue, you have mentioned, and when we talked earlier about listening and dialogue, you know, which is very different than just talking in the casual sense of talking, has to be sustained. You know, Marlene, I'll speak a little bit for Marlene here. Marlene worked for 10 years as a dialogue facilitator in a citywide dialogue project in Boston. And that project would bring groups of people together. I mean, there are lots of different focuses for these groups and who was in them, but, you know, reasonably sized groups where people could talk to each other and have a number of meetings and commitments to actually come to all of those and to talk about very specific issues and their experiences. So these would be people who were built into the system to be in conflict, or they had been in conflict for some reason related to race. And, you know, when she did that work, you know, we're white, both of us are white. She did this always with a co-facilitator, and they always would be one white person and one black or brown person. So, you know, this was a process through which she learned a lot, I mean, herself, not just about the importance of listening and conversation, but of dialogue in a sustained way. And, you know, I did work at Clark University over a number of years on a project that Clark had called Difficult Dialogues. And each year the topic changed for those dialogues. But these were sustained conversations, and faculty members who participated were encouraged to have certain things in their classes where they could at least sustain over the period of a semester, a focus on something and teach some dialogue, you know, and listening processes. So all of this is so critical in addition to needing to solve a problem right now. It's learning a way of thinking. It's learning how to engage with people, to build some trust, you know, to hear people's stories, to get a grasp of what experience is like other than yours. And that's not something you can do in one session. One session can be terrific in the sense that you learned something, either because somebody was talking and you were listening to them, or you were conversing and maybe, you know, having some of your viewpoints put into a perspective you haven't thought about. So that's very important. But just as important is to be able to be with people in a sustained way, whether it's at in a work situation with colleagues or a neighborhood situation or some organization that you might be involved in, but some opportunities that are more than just getting together at a moment.
My guest today is Fern Johnson, Senior Research Scholar and Professor Emerita at Clark University. She and her co-author Marlene Fine are white parents of African-American sons. They co-authored the Interracial Adoption Option, and their latest book is Let's Talk Race, A Guide for White People. And this really is a guide for white people who want to have these conversations but are uncomfortable. They struggle to speak about race. This is to help white people begin to have these conversations and to have dialogue. My opening question was about, you know, why do white people struggle to speak about race? I know there's a myriad answers to that question, but what is the most important answer to that question in your view?
I think usually it's a combination of being reluctant, afraid to say the wrong thing, and simply not knowing what to say. I mean, that's three things, but it's really one. It's about holding back for a number of reasons that either have to do with what we know or concerns about what we might say. And again, we go back to this notion of the importance of dialogue and conversation. We don't teach people how to have these kinds of sustained conversations, you know. We learn in school how to write. We learn how to give a presentation on our, you know, our project. We don't learn how to have sustained, productive conversations in which listening is the most important. You know, it's very easy when you're having a fraught conversation or about a topic that's controversial to be preparing your answer. What you're going to say. You know, missing half of what somebody else has said.
A debate. You're becoming defensive. You're defending your position or
defending your
side of the conversation, for that matter.
Right. Defending. And sometimes, Rich, it's not even that you're defending it. It's just that, oh, this person said X, and okay, now I'm going to say Y because I want to get my point in. Your point might have nothing to do with what the person just said. It might be on the general topic, but it might not really be about that point. You just want to say it because it's important to do that. Well, you can't get too far on a particular topic if that's what's happening in a conversation.
I was struck by one of the first things you do in the book is you show the varied forms of racism and what happens in conversations oftentimes is we confuse interpersonal racism with systemic racism or societal racism.
Yes.
And that sort of shuts down the conversation from the get-go.
Absolutely. You know, this idea that I'm not racist, you know, somebody's saying or feeling, you know, this happened. Some person individually did this, and that's terrible. Well, yes, some person maybe did something that was racist, and that was terrible, but that it's not really happening everywhere. I mean, just, you know, a couple of comments about our experiences as white parents of African-American sons would happen to us so frequently that somebody would say something about, you know, what happened to a black person. And then either explicitly or we could get the point, but that wouldn't happen to your sons because blah, blah, blah. You know, where you live or they haven't been to that place or they don't go there or... And it was like, well, no, this can happen to them anywhere, you know. We would tell, you know, people stories, you know, our personal stories as witnesses. You know, we're witnesses to what happens to our son. We're also involved as participants in our family and what have you, but things that we witness. And we would see these like horrified reactions, like someone would say, I cannot believe that they would have handcuffed your son for this tiny thing. Well, they did, you know. So, you know, and, you know, Marlene and I thought that we knew a lot about all of these issues, you know, forms of racism and the white privilege and we had read tons of stuff, of course, and you know, taught. And I think we knew quite a bit, you know, before we adopted our boys. But boy, we did not know so many of the things that were important for us to know. And we had to learn them. And, you know, we needed help from black friends and colleagues, all of our BIPOC friends and colleagues. We needed help. You know, we needed sometimes to just be told that we had to do X or Y, you know, because we didn't know through our experience.
Yeah, and when it comes to race, I would imagine that even as white parents, you don't experience that issue the same way a complete family of color would experience the situation, too.
Absolutely. So, I mean, when our children were young, you know, there we were. We're white. You know, we're professors. We have these two African-American sons, and, you know, most people think, you know, they're adorable. But we can or could, we could, when they were young, sort of pass our white privilege over to them in a number of situations. They were protected, you know, to a large degree, not completely, but they were protected by that. Then, you know, as they get older, you start to get into situations where you're not with them as much. They're maybe telling you some but not all of what's happening. And then you don't know. And we have definitely learned over the years that our radar about race issues had to get amped up, and it will never, never be as good as a parent of color. You know, it just will not, you know, because it's not the experience that we have had. We can get better. We can listen. We can talk to people, but it's tough.
My guest today is Fern Johnson. She's a senior research scholar and professor emerita at Clark University. She and her co-author and partner, Marlene Fine, are the authors of Let's Talk Race, A Guide for White People And the book really is a guide to have these conversations, to begin having these conversations, descriptions of the varied force of racism, how we normalize privilege, and how privilege plays a role in our daily lives. And also, it talks about some of the most important ways to have these conversations. First of all, when you're having a conversation about race, it's so important to listen, and to listen compassionately and not, there's a number of examples where, you know, listening intently and not chiming in with your own experiences, listen to those experiences. How important is that?
I can't stress how important that is. I mean, it is absolutely the foundation for building trust and developing relationships. People probably almost universally, I don't know if I'd go that far, but people need to know that they are understood if they are going to trust. So if I'm in a situation or any person is in a situation and presenting myself all the time, what I think about something, what I believe we should do, what I think the problem is that needs to be solved, but not listening carefully to what somebody else is telling me, that is going to be the biggest impediment to trust. If there's going to be meaningful, long-lasting solutions to many of the big problems we face and the smaller ones that are pieces of that, there has to be trust.
And one of the things that really shuts down a lot of conversations is the idea that we only think of the present. We don't deny history's impact on race. And I'm not saying denying history, but denying history's impact. This is continuing, and there are still court cases going, winding our way through our court system, which is looking at denying history's impact. Can you talk about that, how that impedes conversations, honest discussions and dialogue on race?
Well, there are a couple of important points about this that I would make. The first one is that we are generally, as a society, very ahistorical. You know, we don't teach a lot of history. We don't generally think that, you know, the past is very important. I mean, in these big analyses of different cultures and their orientations, you know, Americans tend to look at what's going on now and to the future less than to the past. So we don't learn very much formally in terms of history at all. But then if you take something specific like the history of African Americans in the United States, that's slim. I mean, it's more than it used to be, but it's slim. What happens in terms of lived experience is that people do know something about their family histories, and learning about one's family, and I'm not talking here about genealogy and ancestry.com and what have you, but, you know, just you're in your family and you have family members and there are stories about what happened to members of the family or generations past. Well, that's a lot of history. So if you're learning the history just of your own family, that is its own narrowing. So I learn about, you know, the immigrant experience of, you know, the Johnson family and my mother, the Moldenhauer family. So I know a little bit about that. And I know I've had many conversations, you know, about, you know, my aunts and uncles and cousins and great aunts and uncles and what have you. So I know that history, and I can recognize that history in different things that I might see today. African Americans have a very different history, and we need to know about it because this is fundamental, basic to the whole American history narrative. And we just don't know about it. And it's offensive to African Americans often when we express ignorance, don't understand something that seems to be the most basic idea, you know, whether it's something like, you know, slavery was a cause of the Civil War. There's startling research on what.
Yeah, you know, that's true.
On
still
that
to this day. Yeah.
So, you know, it's offensive. It's hurtful. You know, it's a way of sort of dismissing or so that's the impact. And, you know, we can't all be historians. I mean, goodness, I mean, but, you know, we can do better and we can improve what, you know, students at all levels are learning. And maybe we're starting to make a little dent in that.
Right. And it's interesting because, you know, when slavery ended, a lot of people think, well, okay, things were different. But you have to look at housing policies were racist up until the 60s, 70s, and maybe even longer, where people couldn't accumulate wealth, the economic well-being. And so all of that needs to be acknowledged and at least known when you're having conversation.
Absolutely. I'm thinking of the example of redlining. Now, I am guessing that redlining was just not known to almost all people until relatively recently, when now it's in the news. Now, that still means not everybody knows about it. But what happened in the early part of the 1900s began then in terms of keeping black people in separate neighborhoods.
Or all people of color. It could be in California, it could be Asians. Yeah.
Yes, all people of color. And, okay, I knew about redlining quite a long time ago. You know, I just learned about that somewhere in whatever, you know, research I was doing related to my academic work. It was only within the last year that one of my nephews said, oh, hey, you know, are you talking about X in your book, doing anything about, you know, redlining? And I said, well, we mentioned it. He said to me, have you seen the documentary Jim Crow of the North? And I said, no. He said, oh, well, you've got to see it. You know, it's a PBS, Minnesota Public Broadcasting, I think, did it. He said, it's about redlining and housing covenants in Minneapolis. Oh, well, I knew that Minneapolis was segregated by any major city, that you can go to various sessions. I knew nothing about this. And, I mean, it was amazing to watch this one-hour documentary about what happened from 1910 forward and its impact today. You know, this is exactly the example that, you know, you were talking about.
Yeah. Name of the book is Let's Talk Race. Fern, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting us.
Fern Johnson is a senior research scholar and professor emerita at Clark University, specializing in race, culture, and language. She's the co-author of Let's Talk About Race, A Guide for White People. It's published by New Society Publishers. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.